join the grand industrial band. So would you from misery and hunger be free? Come on, do your share like a man. There is power, there is power in a band.
Welcome to In the Hive, I'm Roger McDonough. Well, if you're a longtime Salt Laker, then the name Ammon Hennessy might ring a bell. In the 1960s, Hennessy ran an aid facility here in Utah's capital city for the homeless called the Joe Hill House of Hospitality, named for the labor songwriter and cause celeb of the early 1900s, who in 1915 was executed at the state prison in what is now Sugar House Park. Anyway, as I said, this facility, named in Joe Hill's honor, was run by a social activist, ardent pacifist, and anarchist by the name of Ammon Hennessy. The vision of the Joe Hill House?
Well, the vision of the place was modeled on the Catholic Worker House on the Bowery in New York City. So it would take in all kinds of transients. The homeless, people passing through, a lot of alcoholics, people down on their luck. And it quickly grew to the point where they were taking in 25 men a night to sleep in this facility, and they were feeding lunch every day to about three times that number.
That's...
My name is William Marling. I'm a professor of American and World Literature at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio.
Last month, Professor Marling was in Salt Lake City for the launch of his new book, which is a thorough, deeply researched biography of Ammon Hennessy.
Ammon Hennessy was probably one of the two or three best-known Catholic worker radicals in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and here in Utah in up to 1970 when he died. His previous history was mostly in New York City, in Arizona, New Mexico. He traveled a tremendous amount giving speeches about his way of life, anarchism. And he had passed through Salt Lake a lot of times. He came here almost directly from working at the Catholic Worker House in the Bowery of New York City. He made a kind of exploratory trip out here in 1961 to speak to students at the University of Utah. And he was simultaneously telling people back at the Catholic Worker on the Bowery that, yeah, I think I might go out to Utah and start a house for the homeless there. It was kind of provisional, but then he got some money from Dorothy Day, who was the co-founder of the Catholic Worker, along with Peter Morin. And he came out here with one of his admirers, a woman named Mary Lathrop. And they settled in over on the near west side, and they were actually picking cherries in Bountiful at 3 cents a pound for about 6 months as they scouted out a place for the Joe Hill House and St. Joseph Refuge. Finally, they got donations from followers back east, and a student at the University of Utah raised what was then the phenomenal sum of $250. Mm-hmm. They found this place at 72 Post Office Place and moved in. And pretty soon they were in operation here.
Operating the Joe Hill
it got shortened to the Joe Hill House pretty quickly.
Okay.
And it was clear that that's how Ammon wanted it to be called. The St. Joseph's Refuge part was Dorothy Day's addition, and it secured her funding, I think.
Huh. And how did they secure the food that they were using to feed people? How did they pay for that?
Great question, and something that really makes you proud to be a Utahn. There was a period of almost magical giving. People gave them food in prodigious amounts. Even the Spud Nuts franchise here gave a weekly allotment of, 100-day-old Spud Nuts. They had grocers giving them old cans, including cans that the labels fell off, so nobody knew what was in them.
Mystery.
And the famous folk singer Bruce Phillips, known as Utah Phillips, was the cook at the house. And he tells a wonderful anecdote about how he didn't know whether it was cranberries or pineapple or baked beans. He just took the top off and put it in, and that stew got deeper and richer all winter long. But the old timers knew you put your fork in all the way to the bottom because that's where all the good stuff was. All of the food was given to them for free. They had a circuit. Ammon had a shopping cart, and he walked miles every day. Some days he went to the bakeries and collected all baked goods. Other days he went for fresh produce, vegetables, and fruit. And he wheeled it all back. He probably walked 6 or 7 miles pushing his cart every day. And on the way back to the Joe Hill house, he frequently gave out from the cart food. He had a favorite barber that he gave food to, and there was a gypsy fortune teller right at the corner that he always left bread with.
How long did the Joe Hill house operate for?
Well, there were three iterations. The first Joe Hill house lasted about 3 years before the city health department came down on him for sanitation issues. He confronted them and said he would go to the Deseret News, which was his big friend. The Deseret News gave him more publicity than the Salt Lake Tribune, ironically. He got the mayor and the city council to give him a reprieve this first time. But on one of his speaking trips back east, they kind of closed in on him. And when he came back, they said, okay, this is it. Now, to their credit, and in typical Salt Lake fashion, officials from the health department drove him around for about a week to try and find a new location.
Didn't he actually end up buying a home as well with funding? And maybe that's the third location.
The second location was also a rental, and that was a little bit farther south. That lasted for a couple of years. Then the third house, which was down by a rail yard at about 2000 South, was a rent-to-own kind of a deal, only it was a working-class neighborhood, and the neighbors knew who he was by this point, that he was coming. And they got up in arms, and there was a guy across the street who said he would break every window in the house if Ammon moved in. So that one was rather short-lived. Mm. But there were three houses in all. They lasted up until about late in 68.
Again, you're hearing from William Marling, author of a new biography of Ammon Hennessy, who ran the Joe Hill House, a kind of homeless shelter and aid center in Salt Lake City in the 1960s. And as you heard at the end of that clip, the same kind of NIMBYism, not in my backyard-ism, that exists when it comes to shelters today, yeah, it's not exactly new. For another take on what it was like inside the Joe Hill House, here's Ammon Hennessy himself in a 1962 interview broadcast on KPFA radio in Berkeley, California.
But we have men there that come in and wash dishes. I buy them a pack of cigarettes a day if I got the money for it. And they wash dishes or they scrub the place out, about three men to take care of.
How big is this place?
72 feet long and 16 feet wide.
Well, is it just a shell, just a room, or is
it
a house?
It's a long, no, it's just a one big long number 10 on Post Office Place is Dun and Bad Street. That's the first number. The last number is ours, number 72. So we're right there near the post office. It's Skid Row right around there, and near the yards, near the Salvation Army is to the yards. And the yard master sends the fellows to jump off the freights. We have dozens of bundles of clothes and people that come and blankets. They leave their bundle there, leave their grip there. They go hunt for work. They get a day's work or two. Well, I said, we make them sandwiches and say, go on now. You can stay as long as you want, or go. A sheep herder stayed all winter. You can go. And some of them say, around there, they'll hand me a dollar once in a while, kind of a tithe, you know, a 10%. I said, well, now, if you can afford it, it's all right. I got to pay the rent somehow. But don't go barring it back tomorrow. You won't get it.
Post Office Place, where the first Joe Hill house was located, and which Hennessy is describing there in that interview, is now called Market Street. It runs between Main Street and West Temple, in between 3rd and 4th South. Bill Marling's new biography is called Christian Anarchist, Ammon Hennessy, A Life on the Catholic Left. And you've now heard Marling mention a couple of times something called the Catholic Worker Movement. Understanding that movement is kind of fundamental to understanding Ammon Hennessy.
The Catholic Worker Movement started at the beginning of the Great Depression. back east, a French theologian named Peter Morin came to the United States with the idea that no people were ever poor as long as they had farms. As long as they had a connection to the earth, they could always have a kitchen garden and support themselves. Now, Peter was not very good at organizing, and so he went to Dorothy Day, who was at this point a radical journalist and a Catholic in New York City, and said, "I need you." He literally showed up at her apartment and said, "We're going to start a newspaper." And she said, "Okay, but it's going to be called the Catholic Worker," because of her interest in labor movements. Mm-hmm. And so they started this, and it was a really dominant force on the left during the Great Depression. Ammon, at that point, had just been dispossessed of his homestead back in Wisconsin. He had taken up land, he had paid for it, but he was making this kind of living. He was gardening and largely self-sufficient.
Yeah.
Then he could not make the payments on his property, so he had to move into Milwaukee, where he started to be really an active labor organizer, founding unions and agitating for better pay and kind of looking out for some kind of national organization. The radical Catholic left was pretty strong in Wisconsin, and Dorothy Day came out to talk to these groups. So did Peter Morin. And Ammon attended. He was the first person to jump up and ask a question, and he was recognized. Somebody knew, oh, you're the guy who spent 2 years in prison.
Yeah. Why did he spend 2 years in prison?
This goes back to his upbringing in Ohio. While he was a junior at Ohio State University, he was active in both the draft resistance movement for World War I and in an anti-rent organization. And so he was the big man on the left at the Ohio State campus. He had the Socialist Club. So in the run-up to World War I, the draft was just like a blanket that spread across the country. His hometown newspaper published a list of every young man who was eligible for the draft. And if you did not sign up, you were publicly shamed. Your neighbors knew that you were one of these draft resistors. Didn't matter to Ammon Hennessey. He was down there in Columbus agitating, and then there was a big speech that was supposed to happen. The socialist candidate for president was going to speak at the most important downtown corner in Columbus, Ohio. And Ammon had orchestrated this whole thing. The speaker didn't show up because there were 15,000 people on the streets and the police said this is too dangerous. But Ammon held forth standing on the State House steps where the local police could not touch him. And then when he got down, they arrested him, only held him overnight. And the next day, he went on the road with all of his stickers, as he called them, and his revolutionary pamphlets. The pamphlets would seem to us kind of innocuous today, but they urged people to organize against the draft. And according to the federal law at the time, that constituted a conspiracy to defy the draft laws. So he became a wanted man. He went on the road, and there was such a pro-war sentiment that at every town, he had to leave quickly because there were informers every place. When he got back to Columbus for his initial minor offense, they were waiting for him. Nevertheless, he and his sisters went out and leafleted downtown Columbus, and they put these stickers on merchants' windows and
just defiant.
Yeah, totally defiant. About 2 a.m., they found him, arrested him, and that was his last day of freedom for 2 years.
Yeah, and some period of time spent in solitary confinement, as I understand it.
When he was sent down to Atlanta, he tried to organize the prisoners. He organized a strike of the workers on a building site, and so they stuck him in the hole. Yeah. And that's where he really had his conversion experience.
Because he was reading a Bible.
He had come from a very religious background, but it was a Quaker and then Baptist background. He was actually baptized in the local Baptist church in Negley, Ohio. The Sermon on the Mount always stayed with him. And there he was in solitary confinement with some really bad criminals all around him, murderers who were being water tortured across the hallway. And the warden came in and said, "You're next. You're not going to get out of here for 2 years." Across the way in the prison shops, he could see Alexander Berkman, who was his hero, and he knew that Berkman had done 2 years in solitary confinement. So he said, "I can do this." But with what spiritual support? All he had to read was a Bible. He kept rereading the Sermon on the Mount. Mm. And then it got so bad that he decided, "I'll commit suicide."
Wow.
He had as his tool a spoon that he sharpened. He thought, "I'll just cut my wrists and I'll bleed out." But the night that he planned to do this, he had a kind of dream, and he saw himself dying in a pool of blood, just like the hogs that they had slaughtered back on the family farm in Negley, Ohio. And he also saw his Quaker grandmother admonishing him for not having enough courage. So he woke up and he decided, "No, I can endure. I can do this."
Wow.
He called it his celestial bulldozer. It was his Quaker grandmother and his reading of the Sermon on the Mount as a kind of primary religious document. You can always turn the other cheek. You can turn the cheek and you can keep turning that cheek.
So a pacifist activist, somebody who for many, many years refused to pay taxes as a protest against military spending. And I'm wondering if you can talk about, I mean, also anti-nuclear proliferation and organizing people to go and protest that, protesting the, you know, Dugway proving grounds. How did the government view this guy? I mean, he got out of prison. He must have gone back on various occasions, I'm assuming.
He did.
Yeah.
He did. Most notably for protesting against nuclear missiles and the site up in Nebraska, which was a prime potential launching pad. But to taxes, because people always want to know,
yeah,
how did this guy not pay taxes?
Yeah, how did he not pay taxes? And how did, and he didn't pay taxes for decades, right?
He didn't pay taxes for probably 30, 40 years. He had some tactics that he learned when he was working in New Mexico. That is, he traded with the Indians who were tax exempt. He was living close to a Latinx community as well as the Pueblos, and he traded some items from his kitchen garden for things from their kitchen garden. He had apples and he raised vegetables, but he would trade those for other fruit, for flour, which he ground himself. So he had a kind of cash-free economy for a long time. He also made deals with bus drivers that if they took him up to Albuquerque, he would drop off some package. But the big thing that he devised as a workaround was he worked for right-wing anti-government ranchers who also didn't believe in paying taxes. And so they would house him and also pay him on a cash basis. The result was that they were harassed by the IRS. And they were told, "You better withhold taxes from this man Hennessy's salary or we're going to put a lien on your property." These guys didn't care. And they paid Hennessy off the book, so they claimed, "Oh, he's not with me. You know, he belongs to that guy over there."
Yeah.
He's just, and he was in fact traded back and forth among these big orchard owners in the Rio Grande Valley, who were busy carving up the Rio Grande River and really exploiting the water rights. In many cases, stealing the water rights from the Pueblos and the Hispanic communities. So this dodge continued all through the Arizona period, too, where he had an especially generous benefactor who he really stayed with until the man died. And that was the period in which Dorothy Day began coming out to Arizona to meet Hennessy. She came out, you know, it was a literary, it was an epistolary relationship at first. They wrote to each other almost every day in the early 50s. And finally, wow, she said, well, I'll come out and meet you. And they spent a couple of weeks together just traveling around, meeting the local Catholic hierarchy. By this point, he was pretty well integrated into the Arizona and the New Mexico churches. He knew everybody down there.
I wonder if we can juxtapose that against the Catholic hierarchy during his time here in Utah, because it seems like, from my understanding, you know, the kind of radical workers' Catholicism wasn't necessarily the thing that was dominant here in Utah at the time, in this diocese.
No. Initially, he got a much warmer reception from the local Mormon hierarchy, who had an idea of what he was trying to do, and what he described was similar in communal agriculture to what they believed. So the Catholic Church in Utah in the early 60s was just trying to attain a foothold. They were trying to be middle class and regular and not offend anybody. I think they had maybe 8 parishes, and the LDS Church had over 200, maybe even 300 local churches. So the Catholics were playing it very, very conservative. And eventually, the bishop said, you know, you do not have our authority to represent the Catholic Church in Utah. Nothing that you do, and nothing that you do should you claim to be representing us.
Well, now, the bulk of the men who come through are en route someplace else.
Yeah,
anybody
with any sense wouldn't stay in Salt Lake for long. As isn't a Mormon, because you got, why should you? Right to work law, 75 cents an hour if they can get by with it, and bum checks even then.
They do have the right to work law in Utah.
Yeah, they have that, and it's the accepted thing is the most conservative thing. But the tradition of the Mormons was the way of cooperation that the Brigham Young had, and to go ahead and the United Order and live together as brothers, that's the tradition. And I have a picture there on the wall. As you go in, you see saints. We've got saints and life-size saints and Christ and Little Flower and St. Anthony. But we also have a picture about 7 feet long of the Mormons coming from Nauvoo to Salt Lake City in 1847. Maybe our bishop wouldn't like it. Well, that's all right. But these were noble, good Mormons that died on the way, a lot of them, see, and they sacrificed. Well, now 6% or 33% loan sharks, that's the thing.
William Marley, I'm wondering if you can tell us how you got turned on to the story of Ammon Hennessy. Like, what's your connection to this story?
I was a freshman at the University of Utah, working as a reporter for the Daily Utah Chronicle, but also working nights as a night librarian at the Salt Lake Tribune. And my friend, who was the photographer there, had taken some pictures of Hennessy picketing at the state capitol. One day he was driving me home, and we passed Ammon picketing on the sidewalk. He said, that's the guy that I just took the pictures of. I was, oh, he's pretty interesting-looking character, his white hair flowing in the wind and all of his signs on sticks there. So then when he died in January of 1970, I went to the news editor at the Daily Utah Chronicle and said, I want to write the obituary. And I did, and it was a front page of the Chronicle and got a little bit of attention. And it was also a time when my friends and I were trying to decide what to do about the draft and the war in Vietnam. And my number came up number 12. So I was definitely going to be called up. And I started to formulate my own conscientious objector statements. And Ammon was an inspiration for me and for several other people. So I filed my CO papers, and I waited and waited. And then Nixon canceled the draft.
Wow.
But I kept accumulating material on this. I went back to New York later and became a journalist for Time Life, first at Fortune and then at Money. And I used the Freedom of Information Act on my Time Life letterhead to get the files from the FBI on Hennessy, and I started building this archive, thinking someday I'll do something with this.
I guess what I'm wondering is there a sort of present-day inheritor? Is there something like what Ammon Hennessy was doing happening right now in America?
Great question, and the first time that anyone has asked me that. Yes, there is. On the one hand, there is a national group called the Buy Nothing organization, which is goes beyond the Salvation Army and thrift stores. It asks people to use the internet to repurpose practically everything. But right now, in France and Italy in particular, there is what is called the degrowth movement, degrowth décroissance in Europe, which emphasizes not just a kind of steady state or an ecologically conscientious social model, but making it smaller, that we don't, everybody doesn't need a car and a ranch house. Make it smaller, do with less. And this is quite active in France at the moment.
Again, the book is called Christian Anarchist, Ammon Hennessy, A Life on the Catholic Left. You can find it in those places where you buy books. For example, Ken Sanders Rare Books here in Salt Lake City, just about three blocks east of that original Joe Hill House location. Ken hosted a reception for the launch of Professor Marling's book back in April.
He comes black wind by gray eagle, waiting on high horses.
I have to admit that the story of Ammon Hennessy feels a little bit alien to the America we're living in today. A lifetime dedicated to poverty and service, to ardent pacifism and anarchism. I don't know, it's just a different time altogether, and it really feels far away from where we are now. There's a great deal that we did not get into in this show just in the interest of time. The story of Dorothy Day is one you should read up on as well. We heard from Ammon Hennessy himself from radio clips earlier in the show. Those clips were courtesy of the Pacifica Radio Archives, a historic collection of recorded community radio history since 1949, with over 60,000 titles over at pacificaradioarchives.org. You've also been hearing excerpts of a 1964 recording from Inside the Joe Hill House. It features, among other things, the voice of Bruce Phillips, later pretty well known as Utah Phillips. He was somebody who helped out around the Joe Hill House. And you've also been hearing the voices, sometimes in song, of the people on the street staying at that aid center in 1964.
Oh, why don't you work like other men do? How the hell can I work?
That recording, there's about an hour and 15 minutes of it altogether, was made by the late Mark Richmond, a singer-songwriter of the era and a founding member of Smoke Blues Band. The recording is courtesy of Reverend Willis, and you can find out more about him at revwillis.com. I also have to credit former Salt Lake Tribune journalist Jeremy Harmon for connecting me with a lot of this archival material. Harmon also spearheaded an incredible multimedia reporting project for the Tribune, a deep look at Joe Hill's trial and execution. Just search Joe Hill and Salt Lake Tribune online and you'll find that pretty easily. And my thanks once more to Professor William Marling for telling us some of the stories that he gathers in his new biography of Ammon Hennessy. That is all the time we've got for on the show today. I'm Roger McDonough. You've been tuned to In the Hive here on KCPW. Join us again next week.
I saw you here last night, alive as you.
standing by my bed. They bring you on a murder charge. Says you're what I ain't dead. Says you're what I ain't dead. Well, the copper was his guilty joke. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man.